Welcome to the Goodness Podcast, the Middle East's first platform dedicated to tackling women's health in a real and honest way. I'm your host, Noor Tahini. My guest on the podcast today is Dr. Sheethal Kinney, a clinical psychologist at Dubai's Lighthouse Center, who specializes in relationship therapy. She's joining me today to discuss modern marriages, why they're so difficult, and how to start thinking about and working on your relationship differently. Hi, Sheethal.
Hi, Noor.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Good. I'm actually really excited to have this conversation.
Same here.
It's a pretty hot topic right now. It's a question / emotion shared by so many people, especially in light of how difficult this year has been. So I'm really curious to get your thoughts on modern marriage and to kind of get to the bottom of some of the questions that I have, that the Goodness community has, that women I know have, because I've crowdsourced a few questions and opinions, etc. So very excited to have this conversation with you.
Yeah, I think it's a really pertinent topic, regardless of, you know, whether or not there's a pandemic. But even so, I think now that we are in this time, the isolation creeps up on you furthermore, and you start really thinking about, you know, who would I rather be in times like this? And it really gets you thinking about these kind of topics.
Yeah. So to start, let's define modern marriage. So what is considered a modern marriage? In my head, I am in a modern marriage, or I imagine that I'm in a modern marriage because I'm in a marriage that is very different to my parents' marriage, my grandparents' marriage, in the sense that my husband and I both work. My husband and I each have our own incomes. I mean, it's a different dynamic than what I see in previous generations, but I'm curious to know, how do you define it?
Well, I think the way that I would say, you know, what classifies modern, I would use it as a, you know, in opposite to what would be conventional, right? Like if you think of the word modern. And I think conventionally, there are many different ways in which a partner was chosen for you. It used to be arranged. I guess the gender roles were more defined, as, you know, you're kind of drawing this contrast that, you know, you and your partner both work. Whereas I think in conventional marriages, you had sort of the provider role, which the man fulfilled, and the homemaker that the woman fulfilled. I think also the way that marriage was construed as an idea, it was coming together of families. It was kind of an institution that takes care of a larger context in terms of raising children and bringing up society and continuation of society. Like, I feel like the concepts of why one got married and what kind of variables held importance were probably different from the variables that in today's marriages we consider. So from my perspective, a modern marriage would be where we are choosing marriage more for love than for these other variables. We are looking for a lot from that one partner as opposed to what their family has to offer. We're not looking to get married based on a, you know, certain criteria that used to be considered the right criteria for marriage. If you think about, you know, I mean, I come from sort of a Indian subculture, and I think maybe in the Middle East it's quite similar as well. You know, you sort of look at what's the right qualities for a girl. It's like, is she pretty? Is she submissive? Does she cook? can she, you know, have children, I guess? And for the guy, it's like, you know, is he good at, you know, earning and, you know, good family, you know, wealth and these sort of things. But I feel like the variables we look at today and the reasons we marry for today are starkly different.
It's interesting you mentioned that because I've just finished a couple of weeks ago watching Indian Matchmaker on Netflix. I loved it. I thought it was such a cool show. I never realized how much arranged marriages were still a part of Indian culture and how they did it. It was so funny you mentioned what the criteria for a good woman was. And the one that keeps coming up in the episodes was that she had to be good natured. I don't know if that's what you mean by submissive, sort of like...
Well, it's funny because the word that is very, like, the word that's used a lot is flexible. which is actually, you know, code for you'll kind of be, you know, as accommodating, as submissive, as, you know, you'll blend into your husband's family as easily as possible and cause least amount of trouble for for the mother-in-law and the father-in-law.
Ashke's mom, or Akshay. Is it Akshay or Ashke?
Akshay,
did
you watch? Yeah.
Akshay.
Yes, Akshay's mom.
Yeah. Akshay's mom wants a girl who's very flexible.
Oh my God. The gymnast jokes that have come out of that. I mean, it's just hilarious. But it's a reality, unfortunately. It I think it has tweaked a little bit, and I'm not sure, you know, and this is something maybe that is also important to address in terms of what modern marriage looks like now, because I think at least out here as well, you know, in the East, we are trying to preserve certain aspects of conventionality while still trying to have a modern touch to it. So while conventionally everything would be arranged for by the parents, and, you know, you sort of, you know, agreed minimally if you had a choice really to say yes or no, and you kind of went along with it. Now there's still this element of, you know, partial arrangements where the parents might be involved in picking out your partner and introducing you, whereas you still get a chance to meet them, and maybe even there's some courtship. There's, you know, an element of I think especially here in the UAE, I think there is, you know, maybe an engagement that's done, and then you still get to sort of, you know, look for those variables in your partner, like, is this person really who you want to be with? And you still get a choice. So it's kind of a combination almost of the old and the new.
Yeah, exactly. And then I think when you look at sort of the Emirati or GCC, more traditional families, it's a certain format. When you look at Indian subcontinent, it's a different format. When you look at, yes, but in general, there's definitely a move towards what Seema from Mumbai calls love marriages.
Oh, I love how you remember that. Yes, exactly.
I want to go back to something that you touched on earlier when you said that what we look for in a partner today is different. And this is something that, for example, Esther Perel, who is a renowned relationship, I don't know what you'd call her. She's almost like an anthropologist at this point.
She's amazing.
Yeah, renowned relationship expert, has said that the issue is that we are expecting and asking too much of our relationship. So she says you expect your husband to be your lover, your confidant, your best friend, your advisor, your travel companion, your everything. So what is, are we expecting too much from our partners? What should we look for in the right partner? Maybe those are actually two separate questions.
I think I can marry the two. I see what you're saying. What's interesting is that, you know, I'm a big follower of Esther Perel's as well. And she's funny. She says that back in the day, and this is even in the West, right? Not just here. But back in the day, marriage was the place that was, you know, the last place for love. So you had everything else in marriage, but love. You didn't marry for love. You married for family. You married for business. You married, you know, it's like a merger of two investments or properties or systems, but there was not really the place for love there. People found love outside of marriage. Often that's where, and especially, you know, men had that, let's just say, privilege or freedom, whereas women were quite, you know, they had lacked access in that matter. But love was something that you found outside of marriage, and now everything you want to find inside that marriage, everything that, you know, you could possibly fathom, whether it is your best friend, whether it is your gym buddy, your book club, you know, buddy, it's we're expecting a lot. The thing is, if you think about what actually really matters, it's interesting. I don't know if you've heard of Dr. John Gottman. He's like a bigwig in the field of marriage research. And actually, I practice Gottman couples therapy as well. So I follow his work pretty closely. And he says that when we pick our partner, we actually pick our problems. And what I mean by that is that there are going to be many different combinations of traits, many different constellation of traits that could fit as our ideal partner. So there isn't just one box, yeah? However, if you look at all of those combinations of traits that make a perfect partner, they're all going to have the same common denominator of traits that we will not be able to tolerate. So, you know, for example, I would rather have a person who has jealousy issues, I'm okay with that, than a partner who has anger issues. So for me, I know, I'm just pulling an example, that anger for me is a non-negotiable. Or I'd rather have someone who is, you know, who doesn't have ambition, but needs to be emotionally available. Because emotional unavailability would be a non-negotiable. So I think we are quite flexible in terms of the things we like and what we would be happy with. But the traits and the sort of variables that can cause unhappiness in a marriage are a smaller lot. And it is important to understand where you will not sacrifice on those values. And usually, if you think about when the relationship ends, it's when those non-negotiables are being struck at. If that makes sense.
Did you find that sometimes in the first few years of a relationship, which usually is the time when people get married, a lot more exceptions are made around these values? And then once the couple is married and been together for a while, then it all comes to a head in a way, because you accepted certain things in your partner earlier because you were in love and you were, you know, all blissed out. And then when push comes to shove, you realize, actually, I cannot put up with this.
Bingo. I think a lot of my clients, a lot of my work with them is to identify these non-negotiables early on, because we do actually have quite a different sort of list in our mind than the one we should be having when we're thinking about a partner. How often have you heard things like, he should be funny, he should know how to play the guitar, tall, you know, really likes hiking like me, likes books, like a lot of times we talk about interests and we are looking for maybe similarities, or things we admire, perhaps. And what I would want for anyone who's listening to think about is actually focusing on your feelings. So if you think about when I'm in that relationship, X years down the line, or even in the beginning, what are the emotions that I want to feel in this relationship? And what are the emotions that I never want to feel in this relationship? Because we all have different thresholds for different feelings. And depending on our own quote-unquote baggage and our sensitivities that we bring into, you know, the next relationship, certain things are those red flags for us. And I think you're right. A lot of times we ignore those red flags, either because we are blinded by other variables that might not really, you know, they make us happy, but we haven't quite done a full 360 on the situation before kind of committing, or because we actually find ourselves attracted to the wrong kind of person, which is probably a whole nother conversation or maybe part of this conversation. But yeah, that's when sort of things fall apart, when we do have red flags and we've ignored them.
So what is fair to expect of your partner in a relationship? You know, we watch all these Hollywood movies where it's like two peas in a pod have ended up together and they love to do everything together and they're like the bestest of friends and they do, there's this picture that's been painted. In your experience, the most successful long-term marriages that you've seen, what is shared between the two? Obviously parenting, yes, but what else?
Oh, I mean, I wouldn't even say parenting is one of the top things, to be honest. As in, obviously, a lot of couples do end up becoming parents, but a lot of times, actually, parenting is one of the things that starts to push people apart if the foundations are not really quite solid. So the way that I would want to explain this is, So imagine you have met someone that you really clicked with, right? And things go fairly smooth and sort of that Hollywood romance. One of the things that Hollywood doesn't show, and I think starting to probably, but a lot of these stories, they start off with how the, you know, romance starts and the end of the movie is happily ever after. And we don't quite know what it takes to be happily ever after. We don't know what the struggles are, even when you're so-called perfect together. Mm-hmm. So there are, and this is actually, this comes from 40 years of research by Dr. Gottman on what makes marriages successful and what makes marriages deteriorate. And he says there are these nine components that separate the masters of marriage from the disasters of marriage. Okay. If you want to ever Google sound relationship house, you'll see it. It's like actually the picture of a house and it shows you all the components. But to put it simply, there are sort of three major systems in a marriage, in a good marriage. There's the friendship system, the conflict management system, and the joint value growing together system. Okay. The friendship system is as it sounds, it's obviously what is the base of the house, the base of the relationship. It's where things grow, right? You're the beginnings. And right at the beginning, what's happening is that if you picture yourself and your partner sort of having emotional bank accounts, okay, you're making a lot of deposits, right? You're getting to know each other, you're sharing a lot about yourself, you're taking an interest in the other person, you're being very kind to them. You know, you don't have to actually be forced to pay a compliment. You don't have to be reminded to say, I love you. There's a lot of giving that's happening just out of your heart. And when you make these deposits, you're sort of like earning credit with each other, right? And this part's really important because it's literally like a bank where if you have made a lot of deposits and, you know, you have one fight and it's a huge fight, you've made a big withdrawal, you're still sitting in surplus towards each other. However, if you think about what happens a little bit over the years is we start making fewer deposits than withdrawals. And we keep withdrawing, whether it's you know, getting stressed out by life, whether it's the kids, whether it's an external variable, whether it's just, you know, I don't need to tell you that I love you, but I need to tell you you forgot to pick up the dry cleaning. Mm. These kind of things are our compliments are replaced by our criticisms and our complaints. Very easily before realizing it, we can go into actually a deficit as opposed to a surplus. And this deficit versus a surplus mindset is what's called a positive perspective versus a negative perspective towards your partner. And that can literally taint everything that you see in your partner. So a lot of relationships that go downhill, even the good ones, is when it starts to feel like, well, you know, everything was working and we were good, but the effort to keep making those deposits were kind of taken for granted somewhere along the lines. And when you think about how that impacts conflict management, which is the second system of the house, imagine any conflict where you have benefit of the doubt towards your partner, whereas where you don't have benefit of the doubt. Even the smallest of petty disagreements can blow up when you just don't believe your partner, you know, had the right intentions. Mm-hmm. And when you're in a deficit mindset, have you ever felt like, you know, this person says something to you and you're like, no, of course, you know, you did this on purpose or you hurt me, like you didn't mean to. And that's the first thing that happens to us when we go into a surplus, into a deficit mindset is we start to doubt our partner's intentions, not from the perspective of they're going to leave me or they're cheating or any of that, but we start to feel like they're being selfish and they don't think about me. Mm-hmm. And if you believe that your partner does not think about you or is being selfish, then it doesn't even have to be the big fights. It can be something tiny that you're disagreeing on and you will dig your heels in and not be able to communicate. So that is, and I'm really like sort of shortening this. Please tell me if you need me to expand on any of these components. But the conflict management system really is where a lot of the damage that ends up happening. It starts off from the bottom. From the friendship system. But as you can imagine, a lot of people have fights that, you know, once one fight, another fight, another fight, the scars tend to accumulate. And you start to kind of go down parallel roads. And then if you think about the top system, which is, and I'm talking about everything that goes wrong, and I can talk about what you need to do right. But the top system of the house, which is the attic of the house, it's the joint value system. That component is about really how your life values, your goals, your vision for the future align together. How you go from being a you and I to a we. And I call it the family system, but it doesn't have to be even, this is, it applies to people who are not even, you know, parents. There's this, the family mindset that comes in that takes it from this is mine and that is yours. And I have to think about my interests and you have to think about your interests. But actually, how can we, even if we're different, even if we have different value systems or if we have different goals, how do we actually reconcile them? And how do we think about finding a way to make it come true for each other?
I can imagine that when the second level you're talking about starts to fall apart, conflict management, or when a couple ends up actually in a deficit, mm-hmm. it can feel like, oh, I've married the wrong person.
Oh, yes.
But is there such a thing as, okay, let's say your values aligned in the beginning. Is there such a thing as a wrong person in that case? Or is it just that you both didn't work hard enough at the marriage?
So if your values are aligned, I think it depends on sort of what does it mean when you say your values are aligned? You know, so for example, even if values are not aligned, to be honest, that is usually less of a problem than how we go about aligning them. So when you take two people who are extremely similar in many ways, maybe it makes it easier because, you know, it's, you don't really have to exercise empathy. You don't really have to exercise perspective taking because you both have the same perspective. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean there's more love there. That just means it's easier. Yeah. If you're different, you really have to put yourself in the other person's shoes. You really have to take their perspective. You really have to kind of try and understand where they're coming from. And so what happens a lot of times is, and I'll give you an example, the biggest reason for relationship downfalls and why we start to think that our partner is the wrong person for us is what we call a gridlock problem in a marriage. Okay. So there are two kinds of conflict, or there are two kinds of problems, if I had to put it very generally. There's the solvable problems and the gridlock problems. Solvable problems, as the name suggests, there's a solution for it. Okay. Gridlock problems is literally like this. It's a gridlock. Yeah. I can't give, you can't give. We're stuck. Can you guess what percentage of problems in a marriage are solvable versus gridlocked?
I imagine most of them are solvable.
Well, actually, 31%, really? 31% are solvable, 69%.
Oh, wow.
Unsolvable. Gridlocked.
Can you give me examples of gridlock problems or unsolvable problems?
Absolutely. So one of the most common gridlock problems that I encounter is around money. Okay. Mm. So I'll just like paint a picture. So imagine there's Jenny and Sam. Okay. Now, Jenny and Sam both grew up very poor and from humble backgrounds, okay? Jenny, her parents, you know, they were extremely cautious with their money and never let Jenny, you know, buy anything. And she was always, you know, reminded about, you know, if you go without food, you know, this is what's going to happen. And so for her, you know, she grew up kind of thinking, man, one day I'm going to have money and I'm never going to feel like I have to worry about anything. And it's going to be my security. Yeah. So imagine money sort of symbolized for her the value of the relationship she had with money was one of security. Okay. Now take Sam. Sam's parents were also very similar, And they ended up, you know, limiting his means. And he went to a school where his friends had all the nice things. And he always felt left out. And he always felt like he couldn't do the trips that his friends were doing. And he couldn't have the opportunities that his friends had. And he swore to himself that one day when I grow up, I'm going to make money. And no one's going to stop me from doing anything that I want. I'm going to spend the way I want. I'm going to have all the freedom and opportunity that I never got. So his relationship with money, his value around money was freedom, expression, opportunity. Whereas for Jenny, it was security, stability. Now imagine these two come together and go, oh, you know, we've come from very similar backgrounds. We'll get each other. Yeah. And, you know, you kind of say, oh, we had very similar upbringings, blah, blah, blah. But then what happens is every time that, you know, they are out at the mall and Sam goes missing for an hour because he wants to shop and Jenny feels threatened and Jenny's like, you know, she just bickers and says, why can't you just, you know, understand? Why are you just, you know, splurging all of our hard-earned money? And every time Jenny tries to block Sam from doing something, he's like, you know, why are you stifling me? Why can't, you know, you're so stingy, you're so this, you're so that. And the gridlock here is that Jenny's never going to make Sam a saver. And Sam is never going to make Jenny a spender.
So what's the solution?
The solution of a gridlock problem lies actually in understanding the problem. So the reason why Jenny is actually hurting a lot of the times is not necessarily because of Sam's spending habits. It may seem like that. But the reason she actually feels even more hurt is when Sam just doesn't get it. It feels like, man, this is something that's so important to me and I hold this so close to my heart. You know, it's something that I went through and I feel very strongly about. And why can't Sam just understand? It feels personal. The attack feels personal. And similarly, Sam's going, man, I worked so hard in life to marry someone who just makes me feel like this all over again. Seriously, yeah. She's, you know, and so the problem is with the gridlocked issue, we're not able to see that this is not really about me being attacked by the other person. It's actually we are both fighting about something that we have very strong stories around. We have very strong values around, and this is not actually a personal attack. But we are also struggling. So we usually only see our side of it. And trust me, Noor, how often do you see couples actually talk about it in this depth that this is the reason why I feel this way about money. This is where it came from me. And this is why it hurts when this happens. No, we usually bicker. We call one person's calling the other person stingy. One person's calling the other person, you know, a money guzzler or whatever have you. And it's these little things constantly, the bickering over time that just feels like, you know what, you'll just never get it. And I think for us in relationships, when our partner doesn't get it, that hurts more than any other disagreement. Mm. So the solution with the gridlock problem is actually to turn gridlock into dialogue. It's to actually unpack what is it that we're coming at so strongly and fiercely about. And why is it that it's so difficult? And that way we can both be on the same side of the problem and the problem can be on the other side. And we can say, okay, you know what? Actually, I'm not doing this to trigger you. You're not doing this to trigger me. We're both, you know, we've gone through something very difficult and that's why it matters so much to us. So for example, a situation like this, I would say, yeah, maybe a compromise or a temporary solution. And this is the thing with gridlock. There's never going to be a one-time solution. It's going to be a series of solutions that we're going to trial and test and see. We're going to try this out for 6 months. We're going to have one joint account and we're going to have two separate accounts for some spending privileges. We're going to try that out for 6 months and see how that goes. And we're going to come back and we're going to rediscuss it. And this is the thing that typically we don't do with gridlocked issues. A lot of couples that end up feeling like they've chosen the wrong partner is they come at a gridlock, they butt heads, and one of the two feels like they just have to give in, and they call it a compromise, which is not the right kind of compromise, really. And then they resent the other person.
Okay.
and the resentment keeps growing.
That was part one of our conversation. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for part two, which will be released tomorrow. On the next installment of this conversation, Dr. Sheethal will start by answering the question, is there a right or wrong partner? And tackling the tricky topic of compromise.